The case for argument is Fairley v. Fairmint. Mr. Duffy?
Good morning. If it pleases the Court, my name is Daniel Duffy, and I represent the appellants in this case, two current correctional officers and one former correctional officer who is now a Chicago police officer. This case concerns a complaint under Section 1983 for a alleged deprivation of the plaintiff's First Amendment rights by way of retaliation. We have raised, under the rubric of the Saucier case, the analysis proceeds on two different levels. The first level is whether a constitutional violation has in fact occurred.
So do we have appellate jurisdiction?
Yes, Judge, I believe you do. It is our position you do for two reasons. First and foremost, the Supreme Court says you do. In Barons versus Pelletier, 516 U.S. 299, the Supreme Court explicitly held that the prior decision of Mitchell versus Forsyth, quote, clearly establishes that an order rejecting the defense of qualified immunity at either, and then the court emphasized either with italics, the dismissal stage or the summary judgment stage is a final judgment subject to immediate appeal.
What do you make of our decision in Gavin against Wheeler?
Gavin against Wheeler, Judge, dealt with a renewed motion for summary judgment.
Yes. Well, that's our problem here. We have a renewed motion. And Gavin says, at least as I read it, that if the second motion is based on the same arguments as the first, it does not open a new window for appeal. One might say, perhaps, that Gavin should be reconsidered because it's inconsistent with Barron. But you didn't file a reply brief. Indeed, when challenged on appellate jurisdiction, you chose to say nothing whatever.
Judge, if you'd like additional briefing, I'd be happy to do that.
No, the time this to was do that was in the reply brief.
This was the subject, as you are aware, this was the subject of a motion to dismiss before this court, which was denied. The Gavin versus Wheeler case, Judge, in that case, there was a motion for summary judgment filed before one district court judge. The case was transferred to a second district court judge. The motion for summary judgment was renewed before the second district court judge, and the appeal was taken from the renewed motion for summary judgment denial.
But the more important thing about Garvin against Wheeler is that it looks back, it's a post-Barons against Pelletier case, looks back at what the court was saying in Barons, and the court is saying the legally relevant factors are going to be different, it assumed, on the summary judgment stage. There'll be more development of the record. People, of course, as you know, at the summary judgment stage have to put their evidence on the table. And we at least thought at that point that if that wasn't what was going on, if it was really just somebody constantly refiling the same motion, that you couldn't inundate the courts of appeals with literally the same interlocutory appeal over and over again. We needed to see what's different. Has there been factual development? Has there been something to make this now a different motion?
I would say that Barron says you can inundate the court of appeals with the same motion.
No, I don't think Barron says that at all. Barron says may require more than one, quote, judiciously timed appeal. It rests on the notion, the court actually says, the legally relevant factors will be different on summary judgment than on an earlier motion to dismiss. That's a quote from Barron's. And so I don't think Barron's firmly says that our decision was wrong. I mean, certainly we wouldn't have intentionally done that, but I think there's plenty in Barron's to support the notion that if you lose on a qualified immunity motion to dismiss at point one in time, then you just file the same motion 11 months later, that's not what Barron's was talking about.
I disagree that this circuit imposes a requirement that the arguments be different at the motion to dismiss stage and the motion for summary judgment stage. And the
what do you make of the statement then in Wheeler? This is not like Barron's. The defendant presented the trial court with no additional facts collected during discovery.
Well, this was a renewed motion for summary judgment. It was the same. It was a second motion for summary judgment, as I understand Gavin. There's a case out of the Third Circuit by the name of Grant v. City of Pittsburgh that dealt with this identical issue. That's 98 F 3rd 116. And that case, which was decided immediately in the wake of Barron's, handled it this way.
It also says those two motions weren't substantially the same in the City of Pittsburgh decision.
Well, I would contend that neither were these motions.
That's what the court said. Well, what's different about them?
Well, for one, there's different standards to be applied. Number two,
Why?
A motion for summary judgment does...
not if you don't have any facts. You were just making legal arguments both times.
On the qualified immunity argument?
Yeah.
The difference between the motion for summary judgment and the motion to dismiss was the factual certitude that these the employees were, in fact, co-equal employees. There was no claim made during the course of discovery that there was some kind of difference, whether it was seniority or...
There was never any allegation of that, as I understand.
It was not clearly alleged that they were co-equal employees, and while they didn't contest that at the motion to dismiss stage, it was crystallized during the course of discovery and at the motion for summary judgment stage.
That's the difference you want us to rely on.
Well, I would disagree that you cannot have the same argument. This is one argument out of a series of different arguments. This is not the only argument that was raised at the motion to dismiss and the motion for summary judgment stage. There were a host of different arguments raised at the motion to dismiss stage and the motion for summary judgment stage. And at the motion for summary judgment stage...
Different arguments raised at the summary judgment stage, were they based on what you'd learned in discovery?
The arguments made at the motion for summary judgment stage were in part based on what we learned in discovery. But the problem here is that the plaintiffs made a series of allegations, and then we went into a long period of discovery in which over 55 depositions were taken. And then at the end of the day, all the plaintiffs had to support their argument, their position, was their own deposition testimony. And if you go through the recitation of their...
What's wrong with that?
Well, I would submit that there's it's a considerable waste of resources if at the summary judgment stage all you do is rely on your own deposition testimony.
I have no idea what's wrong with that either. I mean, that's why you have trials, but of course we don't just take interlocutory appeals. And in Johnson against Jones, the Supreme Court says even for qualified immunity, if there are disputed facts, that's not what this appeal is all about. You have to take the facts favorably to...
Well, that's... I would submit to you that's the trick bag that the Johnson versus Jones holding and the qualified immunity requirement that only a legal argument be at issue is the trick bag that public officials face when a motion is denied at the motion to dismiss stage.
We can't do anything about Johnson against Jones.
I would agree you can, although I think it's been read considerably more broadly than it need be read.
Let me ask you a different question about the merits. Now, your contention is that it was or is an unsettled issue whether a co-worker can violate the constitutional rights of an employee. Is that your argument?
The argument is, Judge, that it is not a settled issue that a fellow employee can be held liable
now,
for a violation.
Now, what is the theory? Is the theory that the fellow worker is not acting under color of law, or is not, or what? What is the argument?
Well, we have. I think there are two different arguments. I think it goes to a commonsensical notion that Judge Wood can't violate your constitutional right as being co-equals, no matter what she might do in the hallway.
I don't understand that. What if she said she found my opinion so offensive that she was going, that she poisoned me?
Well, we would regret that very much, but...
We would have to put aside issues of justifiable.
That's true. That, I would say, would not be a violation of your constitutional rights. While it would be an assault and remediable by other state construction of state law, it wouldn't be a violation of your constitutional right. Now, if she were the chief judge...
She would be trying to alter the ideological composition of the court.
By poisoning you?
Yes.
And she would.
replacement, right? It would depend on my replacement.
But it would be a real gamble on my part, given that it's election day.
even if her motivation were to change the ideological constitution of the court, her poisoning you would not violate your constitutional rights. It might be a tort.
What if Chief Judge Flom did it to me, it would. That's what I find puzzling, the distinction between the co-worker and the superior.
I would say that if the Chief Judge, to leave the poisoning part aside, if the Chief Judge reviewed the different cases and assigned you to cases where he knew that your views could not make an impact on the case law in the Seventh Circuit, you would have an argument that violated your constitutional right of free speech. You would have an argument that by him imposing on you what amounts to, in the language of some of the decisions, an adverse employment action, that you would have an argument that your constitutional rights were violated. And the way the Supreme Court has laid that out is under the aided in the agency argument. Under the aided
but
in the agency.
Here, let me just cut through this and say, I think you're confusing a line of cases where the legal theory, this is Title VII, requires one to find a basis for employer liability. That's just a prerequisite for a Title VII case. You don't sue the supervisor, you don't sue the coworker, you have to sue the employer. 1983 is quite different. 1983 is a ground where what you have to find is personal involvement of the individual. And there's no respondeat superior liability under 1983. But once you've found that personal involvement, you're really in a completely different legal paradigm. You're not looking for that basis for employer liability. So I'd be very cautious about taking the Title VII cases and moving them over to the 1983 context.
Well, what you say may very well be true. There is no case law in the Seventh Circuit, or I would contend any other circuit, that says one co-equal employee can be held liable on constitutional grounds for something he has done to another co-equal employee, and therefore we argue that we are entitled to qualified immunity because that is not clear under the law.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Duffy. Mr. Pierce?
Good morning. May it please the Court. We respectfully submit that this Court has no jurisdiction over this appeal.
Here's the problem I have with your argument. Suppose there's a motion to dismiss and it's denied, and then discovery begins, and the defendant thinks, well, you know, I could appeal this denial of the motion to dismiss, but discovery may reveal facts, uncontested facts, that's important, that illuminate the issue of qualified immunity, and therefore I'm going to wait. And suppose it turns out that, you know, you never know exactly what's going to come out in discovery. It turns out that really nothing very germane emerges in discovery. Why wouldn't it be appropriate for the defendant to, and then he moves for summary judgment, it's denied, so on. Why wouldn't it be appropriate for him to appeal then? Because if you say that he has to come up with something in discovery that changes the posture of the qualified immunity issue, then he'll automatically appeal from the denial of the motion to dismiss, lest he, you know, have forfeit his opportunity to appeal later.
As a policy matter, there is logic to your question. There is no disputing that. It is, however, not the law as we read it. We think the law is quite clear that you may take two appeals if you wish, but that if the issue that you wish to appeal for qualified immunity is ripe following the motion to dismiss, as we read the Supreme Court case law, it is quite clear that you must then do so.
Well, I would have thought you'd, you're you need to focus on the two appeals part of it. If at the motion to dismiss stage you are not sure if it's ripe, I don't see why you couldn't wait at that point until the summary judgment, file your one motion, and take the appeal then. But I thought the real problem here was that the Court of Appeals was being asked to decide exactly the same motion twice.
Judge Wood, I was exactly my second point. In this instance, Judge Posner's hypothetical is completely inapplicable. There is not now and never has been any dispute that these are co-equal employees. They're deputy sheriffs working at the Cook County Jail. The qualified immunity assertion by these defendants is, as Mr. Duffy has just articulated again, is that there is no clearly established law that co-equal employees may engage in First Amendment harassment. I think that that is an issue which is a complete red herring, but be that as it may, the issue was ripe for appellate review if appellate review was to be sought following the motion to dismiss, exactly as it was following discovery. I mean, what would discovery have possibly shed light on the undisputed fact of the rank of these gentlemen when working at the county jail? So the idea that is behind Judge Posner's hypothetical, simply inapplicable. Whether or not that should be the law, we think it is not. But in this case,
well, rank is a subtle issue. So Mr. Duffy gave the example where the chief judge makes assignments designed to, you know, warp the decisions of the court. Well, a judge who isn't a chief judge but happens to be the presiding judge can do the same thing, right?
Sure.
Even though he's the same rank as the other judges.
Surely could,
so
yes.
You can have differences in authority within the same rank.
There's no question about it, but those differences in authority are completely irrelevant to the decided case law with regard to First Amendment harassment. This court, in the Power v. Summers decision, makes it clear that anybody can be harassed, and indeed, First Amendment case law going back decades makes it clear that the government officials may violate the First Amendment by improperly motivated retaliatory and harassing conduct with a broad variety of people, inmates, school teachers, taxpayers, litigants, essentially anybody's First Amendment rights could be violated under the appropriate circumstances. What is particular about employees in the First Amendment context is that they raise a different set of problems.
Could I jump in right there? Because another way of looking at this appeal is that the Supreme Court seems to have left the door open. If there are facts that are different, then you're not just taking a late appeal from the earlier order, or if the law has changed material. And, of course, we now have Garcetti. And I realize Garcetti was decided about 10 days or so after the notice of appeal was filed in this instance, but nonetheless, there it is now, a very important Supreme Court decision on the question of public employee First Amendment rights. And I understand part of it's pending in the district court, but why shouldn't we say, well, that at least is the kind of change of law that perhaps should cause us to take this appeal right now?
Well, we've had no chance to address Garcetti in the district court, and because of the jurisdiction...
What facts do you need? What do you need in the district court about Garcetti that you can't do just as well here? Is it anything other than a question of law?
The summary judgment record would be somewhat different, but I'm prepared to argue Garcetti right now, and indeed we have addressed Garcetti in our briefs.
Well, I just want to know, what do you need out of the district court except one more judge's legal opinion? I mean, she's a great judge. I don't have any issue about that, but, I mean, it's not... What do you need from
other than the
court?
Procedural problems, which have jurisdictional issues raised by them, and the fact that we might have crafted a different record? As I say, our position with regard to Garcetti is quite simple. This case is the opposite of Garcetti. In the Garcetti opinion, the opinion of the court written by Justice Kennedy makes it clear that the analysis to be engaged in as to what an employee's duties are is a practical analysis. You don't simply look at the job description and leave it at the piece of paper.
So your argument is it's the code of silence, and that's precisely
that is what this case is about.
Issue here.
That is what this case is about in a fundamental sense and has always been about. It is our allegation that the mandate at the county jail is keep your mouth shut. Defendants, in turn, say there are general orders that say report misconduct. What we say is they have been honored in the breach. Judge St. Eve found ample evidence to go to the jury on that issue, and that is where we believe this matter should be decided.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pierce.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Duffy, well, your time expired, but if you want a minute, you can have it.
I just have one final word regarding jurisdiction, and this court has decided in the case of Kurowski versus Krajewski in 1988 that a public official can appeal on qualified immunity grounds following an adverse judgment, even if he didn't pursue an interlocutory appeal, because treating it as a forfeit would, quote, simply induce public officials to file more interlocutory appeals. I would submit to you that if the court were to adopt a rule that required a motion for summary judgment to be on the interlocutory, on the qualified immunity grounds to be materially different from a motion to dismiss in order to trigger your appellate jurisdiction, that you would be inviting interlocutory appeals at both the motion to dismiss stage and the motion for summary judgment stage, and then following the verdict. So you'll see this issue three times instead of one.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Duffy and Mr. Pierce.